Hello and welcome to the Investors Chronicle Companies and Market Show. I am John Heumann, editor of the Investors Chronicle, joined today by a very special guest, John Rosier. How are you doing, John?
I'm very well, thanks.
Excellent. So readers of the Investors Chronicle will know that John provides a monthly column for us looking at the portfolio that you run on your website, which is...
It's johnsinvestmentchronicle.com.
And it's a live portfolio, so this is stuff you actually own.
Yes.
And what you do on your website and kind of belatedly through us a couple of weeks after... At the end of the month is update readers about exactly what you're doing and why.
And yes, exactly. And so my ISA and my SIP basically replicates that portfolio.
It's really, really insightful. It's really good to see a live portfolio in action, which is why it's really, really popular with our readers.
Yes.
So we're going to kind of have a chat through that today and kind of the thinking behind it and the kind of style you use to approach investing with, some of the themes you're looking at, some of the tools you use. But let's start with a little bit of background. Tell us about yourself.
I'll give it a bit of history. So I started work in the city at Fleming Investment Management in 1984. To start with, I was an analyst in the research department, so that gave me a good sort of basis. I followed the financial share, so banks, insurance, and then a few other sectors like overseas traders, which don't think really exist anymore, or textiles didn't really exist anymore.
But coats, I think.
Yeah, but I mean, it was quite a big sector then, with Courtaulds and William Baird and Nottingham Manufacturing. So, you know, it's quite a lot of companies, but they've gone by the wayside. And then in 1989, I then started managing portfolios. So I moved from research, and I was managing UK equity portfolios for big pension schemes. So final salary pension schemes for big corporates, local authorities, that sort of thing. And in those days, those portfolios would have 60-odd% in UK equities, probably another 20-odd% in overseas equities, bit of property, bit of bonds. But it was, you know, UK equities was the majority of the portfolio.
Yeah.
Nowadays, 10% maybe.
Yeah, well, I mean, that sort of reflects where we are globally in terms of
stock
markets and their relative weightings.
I guess it does, but then there were two big changes, which I think, I'm going to say, ruined the UK pension industry. One was the removal of the tax credits on dividends in the early 90s, and then in 97, the complete removal, which made equities less attractive. And then the other was the move to, mark to market in terms of valuing the pension funds. I mean, why would you have a final salary pension scheme now? But in the old days, it was valued on discounted cash flow. That, to me, made more sense. But anyway,
yeah,
that's history.
So let's talk about the present.
Yep.
You then made the shift to become a full-time private investor.
Yes, various routes. The last, I say, proper job I had was in 2008 when I was set up a small investment management company for, you know, a larger company, so a subsidiary of a larger company. And it was an interesting time to do that. Raising money in 2008 wasn't that easy. But that our parent company was taken over in 2009, and the new owner said, we're not interested in investment management, close it down. So we closed it down. My wife very nicely let me go for a month to South Africa doing a conservation course in the Kruger. And I think she thought when I got back that it would be back on the Northern Line to the city. But actually, I thought I've done that for 25 years, and it was fun. I learned a lot and everything, but I want to do something different. Trouble is, I hadn't really worked out what. So I started investing from home, enjoyed that. And then through various websites and things, got the idea of johnsinvestmentchronicle.com. So I set that up in 2012, January 12. And since then, I've been managing full-time private investor and also running the portfolio on the website.
Yeah, and the two things sort of overlap. So.
They do, yes, totally. 100% really. I mean, it gives me good discipline because I'm up at 6:30. I'm ready for any RNSs at 7:00. Particularly annoying when you have a day like Tuesday where, you know, I've only got 24 holdings at the moment. And so on Tuesday, you get 3 announcements all in one go. So Games Workshop, I knew was coming, but then there was an update from Anglo Asian Mining, and gosh, what was the other one? Oh, it's a good one, Serica Energy, trading update. So by 8:00, I'd scribbled my sort of initial thoughts and all of those and got them out. But I find the writing really helps in terms of discipline.
Yeah.
There's been times when I've looked at a stock and I thought, yes, I'm going to buy it. I've written it up, taken time writing it all up, my reasons for buying it and all that. And then I've got to the end, to the conclusion, and I've gone, you know what? I'm not sure about this one.
I mean, I was going to, having started
thinking I was going to definitely buy it. I mean, that's why I'd written it up.
I mean, one of the questions I was going to ask you is, what is your research process?
Yeah.
And I guess the writing is part of that.
Yes.
What else would you use to help build a picture of a company you might buy or sell, for that
matter? Okay. Well, a good example of one I bought in early December. Renew Holdings, which I held a few years ago. I sold out in 2017 because I thought the valuation had moved too far. And I was just slightly concerned also about its sort of prospects over that time. December, it basically came up. I saw the results statement at the end of November, and I read through that, and I thought that looks a very positive statement, good set of results, good organic growth in the business. So I then looked at the valuation, and I thought, God, it looks cheap. And I could look back at when I'd sold it at, and you know, the dividend yield had moved from 2% to 3%, share price movement and dividend growth. And I then looked on the Investors Chronicle, see the comment there. So that, again, useful to read that. I then went on to Stockopedia and looked at its rating on the stock and what was going on. So that was another good piece of work. And then I went on to something called Simply Wall Street, and it had it as the cheapest stock in the UK market. And I sort of went through all of that on it. And I just, you know, after doing all that, and it's sort of stock I know as well. I've met the management in the past. And so I'm au fait with what market they're in. And I thought, it's a risk worth taking. Anytime you buy a stock, there's a risk that you get it wrong. But in this case, I felt the you know, the risk reward was clearly on my side. I bought some at the beginning of December, and it went up sort of 50% in the next month. Probably helped by the general election result, but you know.
Yeah, I mean, you mentioned Renew in your column this month.
Yeah,
and that perhaps the valuation was being held back by
yes.
by the fear of a
yes.
of a Labour government.
Yeah, but again, to me, there were two bits there. I mean, it's easy with hindsight, but I don't think really anyone expected a majority Corbyn government or Labour government. Mm. So I thought maybe that was being overdone. But the other side of it is, you know, Renew is basically involved in maintenance of critical infrastructure, so the railway network and nuclear, things like that. You know, I just couldn't see it being losing all its business overnight. There's just no way that was going to happen.
Yeah, absolutely. In terms of style,
yeah.
Would you say you had a particular style? Are you a growth investor, an income investor,
investor? I would say I'm a sort of GARPy one, so growth at the right price. So again, on my website, I've updated it recently in terms of my investment approach and all the detail. I mean, I bulk at buying companies where once the prospective PE gets over 20, I start to feel a bit uncomfortable about buying a stock like that. I have done occasionally.
Would you also feel uncomfortable holding a stock where the PE has, where the rating has expanded?
I start to feel uncomfortable, but if I've bought a stock that's on 16 times and it's re-rated up to 23, 24, 25, I'll sort of watch it. But I'm starting to feel uncomfortable because I'm starting to think, maybe, you know, if I do sell this, if the valuation's too high here, you know, how much more can this revaluation go on? You know, if I do sell that, put it in cash, I can then look for another one where I'm looking for a re-rating. So, you know, my ideal stock is something on 13, 14, 15 times earnings, where the earnings are being upgraded. Because once you get good news and earnings upgrades, people start to take notice and they say, why is this only on 15 times? And it gets revalued. So you get that sort of double whammy. So those are the sort of things I look for. I also like stocks that pay a dividend. And once the yield gets to 2 or below, You know, it's the same as, you know, the inverse of the PE in a way. I start to think, well, maybe I can find something to put the money in where the yield's 4% and the dividend's growing at 10 or 15, and maybe that'll be re-rated. So then yields too. Yeah, Renew Holdings, when I first bought that, had a yield of over 3.5 or so, and I sold it in 17 when the yield was down at 2.
Mm. I mean, there's a strong discipline going on here. And in fact, one of the things we spoke about earlier that keeps you disciplined is the closed nature of your portfolio.
Yes.
Can you talk us through exactly what that means and why it helps?
All right. The closed nature just means that when I started John's Investment Chronicle, the portfolio in January 12, I put a lump of money in and I said to everyone, here's this money and this website is all about how I invest that money. So I've never, when I find an idea, if there's no cash in the portfolio, if I find an idea and think, oh, I really want to buy that, I can't just shovel some more money in. I've got to say, well, is it better than an existing holding? And if it is, then, you know, and how sure am I that it is? Because there's always a cost with chopping and changing. If I'm sure it's better than that holding, then out goes that holding and this one comes in. But there's a real discipline in that. You know, the only cash that goes into the portfolio is the dividends that come in. And, you know, over time, they've contributed quite a lot to the performance.
Reinvested.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah.
Reinvested in the same...
No. I personally, I was asked about this the other day. When the cash comes in, it just goes into the cash pot.
So you can deploy it how you like.
And then I can deploy it how I like. Because my concern with just automatic reinvesting is that you might be reinvesting on a day when the stock's just had a 10% run in the last week. Mm. And you wouldn't naturally be a buyer of the stock maybe on that day.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you talk about this, you know, discipline, sort of you getting wary when you get, you know, when shares have re-rated to a particular extent. But having said that, sometimes that might work against you. And there must be lots of lessons you've learned. And I think that's one of them in the years of running these portfolios.
Well, especially in the sort of market we've had over the last, 10 years now, but, you know, certainly last few years, I've missed out on stocks like, Fevertree, because I looked at it and I always went, that's too expensive. And then there'd be upgrades and results. So maybe I didn't really understand it completely and really get the story. And then another one, the Anthony Brown Dynamics, that's just been a tremendous performance. But again, I've always just been put off by the valuation. And I mean, thinking about stocks I've sold too early. Well, there's loads. I mean, I mentioned one in there is Melrose.
Melrose, yeah.
And I kick myself with Melrose because I think they're some of the best management. You look at their record of creating value. And, I should have just bought that in January 2012 and just held it and never sold a share. But I get worried about the markets they're in and things like that instead of just remembering, you know, what good sort of managers they are and good, you know, value creators.
I mean, you say in the piece, you know, if the investment case is sound,
yes,
hang on in there.
Yes.
If you're happy with the research you've done and your understanding of the share, just stick with it.
Yes, up to a limit though. And I guess the other thing will be the weighting I have in the stock. So, a stock, it's one of probably my biggest contributor pounds wise to performance would be Bioventix. And I reduced my exposure to that about 3 or 4 months ago, sort of halved my weighting because I thought the valuation had got too far ahead. And, you know, I have in my mind where I would buy those shares back. And it got quite close to it a few weeks back. And since then, it's gone off about 15%. So I've missed out. But my discipline was, this is, you know, there's a line on my chart where I will buy it at. And I know why I would buy it there. Didn't quite get there. Doesn't matter.
I mean, the time may come again.
I think it will.
You talk in the column this week about the likelihood of a market correction. Talking about patience is one thing, but actually doing it is another.
Yes.
One of the things, the principles that we spoke about your commentary is trying to teach the psychology behind all this.
Yes. Yeah, I think I love the psychology of investing, and there's loads of good books on it. There's one I like called Your Money and Your Mind, and it's trying to keep a sort of even keel. It's very easy to get really excited when you're doing really well. Normally when I start thinking I'm really good at this, that's when I start to worry, because you know that something's going to come and kick you. And you've just got to try and keep an even keel. And when things are going well, yeah, sure enough, enjoy it. But the other side of that is, when you have a bad time, not to get too depressed about it. You know, as long as you've got some sort of method that you're happy with, and you've not taken too much risk in terms of concentration in a poor stock or whatever, then you've just got to try and go through these periods. I mean, I think
you've seen a few.
Well, I see, yeah.
No, I mean, not with this portfolio, but in your career.
No, I have. I mean, obviously, I remember the 87 crash. That was an interesting one. I got married that week, actually, which wasn't a crash.
I got married in September 2008.
Right, okay,
just,
yes.
Just after Lehman's
Wedding. Yes, okay. Well,
just before.
Yeah. Yes, I mean, that was an interesting one, and it was fascinating watching, you know, more senior fund managers who were sort of 30 years older than me, and, you know, how they reacted to it and things, and it was difficult. But then the one that really got me was, 2000 to 2003. That was 3 years of really, really difficult markets, because it was just going down. There were the odd rallies which gave you some hope, and then down it went again. There was very little trading going on at all for three long years, and then it changed. And again, no one sort of rang a bell on that day in March 03, but it changed, and off we went again. But those 3 years, if we had another 3 years like that, it will catch a lot of people out if they've never seen something like that.
And that's something you mentioned earlier, that a lot of people who are investing today perhaps haven't been through these very grim times.
Yes.
And therefore might really struggle to cope when we see another correction like you believe may come soon.
Yes, because, you know, liquidity just disappears. Stocks drop down, even quality stocks. You know, you think, oh, I'm in quality. Well, what happens is people go, oh, I've still got a profit on that stock. So they sell some, and they all come down. And in these, in a proper difficult bear market, you tend to get a lot of sort of valuation compression. So stocks tend to all end up pretty much on the same valuation, which is a great opportunity if you've got cash to invest it then, because it's like going into a sweet shop. There's a little kid and all the sweets are there, and basically they're all the same price, and you can choose the ones you want. And even if you haven't got cash, then it's a good time maybe to do some shifting around and improve the quality of the portfolio.
I mean, in terms of cash, levels of cash holding is something that often gets talked about, how much cash you should have in a portfolio. You always report the amount of cash you have in yours, which at the end of December was very low.
0.3.
But we briefly touched on this. Given your worries about the trajectory of the markets in the sort of months ahead, you've increased that a little bit.
The cash has gone up a little bit. I mean, it's 4.3 as of lunchtime today.
That's in terms of the relative size against the rest of your portfolio, that's quite large.
Yes, I guess so. But I mean, yeah, the market dropped 20% or so, it's not going to protect me that much.
No.
But yes, I mean, so, but you know, it's at 4.3 today. But I'm looking around at different ideas. But the other thing I have done is, I introduced gold last year, so I had the Wisdom Tree Physical Gold ETF. I increased that in January. I've also increased my exposure to the ETF that invests in gold mining shares, and I've got Anglo-Asian. So actually now my exposure to sort of gold or gold mining and physical gold's around 15%. And I sort of have a love-hate relationship with gold, because on one side, I sort of buy into the Warren Buffett, you know, what's the point of it? It doesn't pay you a dividend or anything like that. And also, how do you value gold? You know, it's just worth what people are prepared to pay for it. But looking back, you know, over history, it has been pretty good in times of, you know, either inflation or market sort of dislocation. So it's a good diversifier. I've tended not to hold any over the last 7 or 8 years, but I feel sort of more comfortable given the rest of the portfolio is pretty much, you know, fully invested in equities to have some of that. It'll be interesting what protection it does give me if the worst comes to the worst.
What is it that you're worried about? Why are you particularly fearful about a correction?
But I'm not fearful of necessarily a big bear market, because at the moment, you know, central banks seem to be pumping liquidity into markets and that sort of tends to work. What I'm, I guess, more fearful of is, you know, a correction, which is 10% plus or so. Now, some people say, oh, you just ride that through. But there's always a concern whenever you do have a correction that actually it's going to develop into something worse. So that's why I'm pretty relaxed in terms of, you know, I am pretty fully invested. If we had a correction, but then that looked as though it was developing into something worse than that, then I would let the cash go up higher.
Mm. Should we talk about some of the themes that you've got exposure to in this portfolio? It seems to be there is a strong thematic feel to what you're doing here.
Yep.
You've got a lot of biotech, oil and gas. We've talked about the US in your columns recently. Let's talk about those three in particular.
Okay. Biotech. I, at the moment, have my exposure to biotech through the Biotech Growth Trust, because, again, a lot of people will say, oh, I never invest in biotech. It's very dangerous. You know, it's sort of potluck whether you find the company that develops a successful drug, etc. And I totally agree with that. But as a theme, it's been tremendous. The main thing with biotech for me is that it's been driven by three areas. It's obviously the mapping of the human genome, which has led to lots of developments in terms of making use of that with drugs, but also computer power. So now, you know, the computer power is being used to develop a lot of these new drugs and in research, and then just greater wealth around the world. So sort of a growing, aging and population that's also getting richer. You're seeing more money go into this sort of development. But also, you know, that flows over into health as well. So I own Worldwide Healthcare. So that's much more in the sort of larger pharmaceutical companies than the smaller biotechs.
But you've got both ends of the spectrum.
I've got both. And, you know, biotech, I bought both of those originally right at the start in January 2012. Biotech growth went up like a rocket. For 3 years, it's gone sideways, but it now seems to have broken up again. And the valuations of sort of biotech looks very attractive relative to history and also relative to the wider sort of S&P market in the US.
And I guess the bioventics aside, playing the biotech trend through collective vehicles protects you from some of that sort of individual company drug failure risk.
Yes. And actually bioventics, you see, to me, okay, it is biotech, but it wasn't all about developing a drug.
No,
you know, it's a different business, generating lots and lots of cash, very high gross margins, and, you know, a nice pipeline going out into the future.
That's quite interesting. You mentioned the sort of cash generation profile of bioventics, because let's turn to oil and gas quickly.
Yes.
This is a sector that lots of people have written off.
Yep.
Lots of people won't buy into, for much the same reason they won't buy into a speculative biotech or drug developer, that they think it's binary and the risk of failure is too great. But you approach it in a slightly different way and haven't written this sector off.
No, because, and there are a lot of E&P, I mean, again, it's like biotech in that if you invest in a company and it drills for oil and it finds oil, that can be very exciting. The share price will move like mad. You might make 50-100% more. But if it misses and it's a dry one, then you're down 40%. Thing. So they're not the ones that I tend to go for. The stocks that I've made, good money out of in recent years have all been companies that have generating cash. They have production already. They're generating cash from that. And they've got some development sort of projects going as well that gives you some upside. But the main thing is the cash flow is being undervalued. And so I had two of those were taken over, two North Sea ones, Ithaca and Faro Petroleum. And then the two I hold at the moment are Serica Energy and Rockrose, both, again, North Sea companies, where I think the market still is undervaluing the cash flow that's coming through.
Do you think it's being undervalued on the basis that there has been a real shift in sentiment away from fossil fuels? And do you think that might hold back the potential returns you might expect from them in future?
I think that... Part of the reason is because of ESG, and people are sort of concerned. There's a lot of funds who maybe just won't invest in that area anymore. So I think that's why you have seen the undervaluation. But it's interesting, you know, both of those stocks are performing well this year. And, you know, I think you get to a stage where valuation becomes so compelling that people will buy them. But maybe it does mean they'll never get to the rating that I would hope they would. But I still think there's reasonable upside ahead for them.
Yeah, I mean, we spoke about this earlier. You made an interesting comparison between tobacco and,
yes,
and oil and gas. And
yes.
I quite like your observation.
Yeah.
Perhaps repeat it for
yeah.
the business.
Because, I mean, there was a time, wasn't there, you know, guess it was 15 years ago or whatever, when, you know, the tobacco companies were on very high yields. They were unloved because of what they sold, you know, the sin stocks. But they have performed very well up until, you know, a year or so ago. You had a good 15, probably more, 20 years good growth out of them as they just generated loads of cash, which they gave back in dividends. And people appreciated that and they performed well. I mean, it's difficult to argue that tobacco isn't a sin stock. I mean, basically, the product kills people.
And does it really serve any other...
No, no.
Benefits of society?
No. Whereas oil and gas, I guess, I mean, if you're at an extreme, you might argue that it's killing people because, you know, everyone's... through climate change and etc. But if you look at the huge benefits that the world has seen over the last 100 years from oil and gas in terms of trade growth and bringing people out of poverty, etc., I think it's too early to write it off.
And it's, I wrote about this in an editorial recently. I mean, the actual amount of oil and gas that's used every day.
Yes.
Just yep. keeping the world ticking over.
Yep.
It's just mind-boggling.
It is.
And I just don't see how it's going to be unwound very quickly.
Well, no, especially when you've got, you know, countries in the Far East, developing countries who, you know, people want to drive a car and they're not all going to be jumping into electric cars yet.
Mm. In terms of emerging markets, you don't have an enormous amount of exposure?
No.
A little bit down there at the bottom.
A little bit at the bottom of Vietnam. Vietnam's a great market from the sort of research I've done. You know, I'd love to, I haven't been there, but it'd be nice to go there. But in terms of, you know, balance of payments, etc., and very, you know, well-educated young workforce, and yeah, it's like China was 20 years ago, but or longer ago, but probably in a better position, I think.
It looks like
a bit of a 10-year one.
It looks like a bit of a tentative toe in the water.
Well, it does, and you see, it should really be a 2.5%er. So maybe at some stage I'll add to that.
The one thing we haven't talked about, actually, in terms of how you decide the weightings,
yes,
is a tool that you've introduced quite recently that we haven't actually run in this week's column for space,
yes,
for space constraints reasons, but you have introduced it to the portfolios. This is your risk-reward rating tool.
Yes.
Can you talk us through how you came to introduce that and what it does?
Okay. Well, I mean, first of all, I think most people, you know, they build a portfolio, they might have 20 stocks in it, and they'll probably try and put more in the ones where they have the most conviction and less in the ones that they feel a bit more tentative about. But maybe there's not that much science to it. And that was sort of what I did before. And then I read a book last summer by Mark Simpson called Excellent Excellent Investing, which I thought was an excellent book. But one of the things I took out of that was this thing that he used for weighting his stocks. So he will, and I now do it, for any holding I have, I will look at risk and I will have it high, medium or low. And that's risk is sort of based on things like balance sheet, debt. You know, if there's too much debt, I might be worried about and put it as high risk. And also maybe on business risk as well. You know, are they dependent on one product that, you know, might get superseded or something? So it's sort of an amalgam of the risk to the business. And then reward, I also do high, medium, low. And this is based on what upside I see. So if I can see more than 20% over the next 12 months, and I'm happy to say high, 10 to 20 medium, and less than 10 would be low. And so you then amalgamate those two. Let's take something like a high risk stock, but it's got a high return. Well, I might be prepared to hold that. But normally I would hold that in the hope that at some stage I'm going to be able to lower the risk from high to medium. You know, I think things are going in the right direction. But for a stock like that, I only hold 2.5% of the portfolio. Now, that's what I've chosen. Someone else might implement this and say, well, for a stock like that, I'll only put 1% in. And people should make their own choice. But then at the other end, I mean, what you really want to hold is a low-risk stock with a high return. Now, I can't find many of those, but for me, that then has 7.5%. So I'll put 7.5% in a stock like that.
You haven't got many 7.5%.
Well, I've just got the one, which was Rockrose Energy. And the reason for that was just the balance sheet. You had basically the cash added up to the market cap of the business. And that cash is going up every day as they generated more cash from their assets in the North Sea. But the thing is, my measurement of the risk on it, again, it's a bit subjective, because I could then argue with someone else saying, no, you can never have a oil stock on low risk. I mean, it's got to be medium, but the oil price might collapse overnight or something like that. And I've got some sympathy with that. So the only thing that was really driving me there was just the balance sheet. You know, even if the oil price had collapsed, the balance sheet was rock solid. Mm. So it does mean, therefore, that all the time I'm looking at my stocks and I'm not going, well, that's gone up a bit, I need to take a profit on that. What I'm looking at and saying, am I still happy with my risk reward weighting on it? And if I am happy with that, then I should do nothing. But if it's performed very well, it's gone up 60% in the last few months, and it's gone from being on 16 times to 25 times or whatever, then I might then think, oh, that's not high reward anymore, that's medium reward. Mm. In which case I would then take it down to 5%.
So it's just an extra layer of discipline.
It's a layer of discipline, and it's sort of, hopefully will keep the trading down to just, you know, keep the trading down, which obviously does cost money. I did two trades. You know, that was it. Mind you, in January I've done about five.
A whole five?
Yeah. yeah.
Well,
it's been a good start of the month, and there's been some big moves, and I guess with a couple of them I've felt the reward weightings were too high. That's why I've cut.
Yeah, absolutely. I realised we went off on a bit of a tangent there without talking about theme number three, which was the US. Now, a couple of months ago, you feel you, one of the mistakes you've made,
yes,
is perhaps being underexposed,
yes,
to the US.
Yeah, well, there's a chap who communicates with me, very nice man, and he sent me an email the other day saying, well done on, you know, whatever, 16.2% a year over the last 8 years. But I've had a look, and if you bought the S&P 500 tracker, you'd have done 16% and you could have gone off and done other things. Well, first of all, I'm not sure what else I'd have done, because I really enjoy investing. But, you know, it was a good point. But that doesn't necessarily mean from here, though, over the next 8 years, you'll make more, well, the same amount out of an S&P 500 tracker as I hope to do. But, you know, I have missed out there because it obviously has performed very, very well. And I remember right back in January 12, you know, there were people arguing that the US looked expensive.
Yeah, and, absolutely. You know, honestly, they, on a Cape, yeah,
yeah, absolutely. And they were arguing then, and it was at very high risk and all this, and it's been tremendous. Now, I have had some exposure, obviously, because I've had it through biotech growth, which is predominantly US. Worldwide healthcare is predominantly US, or certainly ex-UK. Then Scottish Mortgage Trust, you know, a lot of that is in the US and in the sort of big, you know, the sort of Teslas and the Facebooks, etc.
I looked yesterday.
Which perform well.
I think 11% is in Amazon.
Yeah.
And I think 6% in Tesla.
Yes.
Which they've had to defend to the hilt
absolutely.
Over the last few years.
Yeah, they have. And I read an interesting article the other day saying they nearly cut it, but they stayed with it, but, you know, having obviously talked to the company.
It's had a great run this year. I wrote about it this week in my editorial.
Yes. Oh, right.
I was very unconvinced as I began my research.
Right.
And kind of looked at it by the end. I was kind of, okay.
Yeah. It's a funny one, you know. I would say, it's very easy to say you don't hold it. Well, I do hold it because Scottish Mortgage, et cetera. But I really hope it does well because
you've got Scottish Mortgage.
Well, yeah, because I've got Scottish Mortgage. But also, I just think you need people like this, you know. They move things forward.
Optimists.
Well, optimists, but also ones who, you know, they put the money there, they have the ideas, and that's how you get things moving on.
Yeah, absolutely. So as well as Scottish Mortgage, you've also got, which I think is a really fascinating stock, ETF, in fact,
the
RoboStocks Global Robotics and Automation.
Yes.
ETF. Yeah. I'm really, really interested in those things.
Well, they've got a fantastic website. I mean, they give a lot of information out. I mean, they write a lot of reports and things on companies they're invested in and all that. So, you know, if you're interested in that sort of area of the markets over the next 10 years, then I think it's a good place to start. But again, I wouldn't know which individual stocks to buy. And I think a good way to play the theme is through an ETF. And they talk about this year and beyond, the sort of big themes in robotics and automation being, I mean, one they talk about in a presentation on the website at the moment is sensing. So they're talking about computers being able to actually sense a lot more. So it's about video, basically, being able to, I mean, obviously, we've got an iPhone where we can look at it, face recognition. But it's really embedding this into computers and the whole system so they can see what's going on and then make things happen. So, I mean, that's a big thing they talk about. I think sounds exciting.
Also sounds slightly terrifying, but there you go.
Yes, yeah, no, ooh, yeah. There's some terrifying stuff around, actually. And then there's, what are the others? Oh, well, AI.
Yeah.
And we see that already. It's starting to happen, but I think that's really going to grow. Obviously autonomous cars and all that. And that's part of the sensing thing. You know, that's going to make autonomous cars, safer and more likely. Then the other was, basically in, manufacturing. And then the other was in logistics. I mean, just more and more robots being used in great big warehouses, moving things around.
Which is what we see in Ocado,
for
instance, which I think is the only UK company in this little ETF.
I think you're right. They've got about 80 holdings or so in the ETF, and I think that is the only UK one, yeah.
Blue Prism might have been in there, but it might not be anymore. I don't know. I did have a look. I might be wrong.
I mean, I actually downloaded as many of the stocks as I could onto ShareScope, so I have a portfolio with them. And it's quite interesting there because you can see what valuations are on. And I was quite surprised because you sort of thought, oh, they'll all be on huge valuations and whatever. But there's a lot of them that are on 20 times with a peg of 0.6 and things like that. And they point that out at the moment, that they can see that valuations are reasonable in the area, and they can see an acceleration in earnings growth over this year and next.
Yeah, absolutely.
So the ETF has just broken out above a sort of 2-year high. Hopefully the start of another leg up.
And apart from gold, that's your only ETF.
Yes, it is, isn't it, at the moment?
Yeah, it is. Would you be looking to add more? They're quite useful for playing some of these.
I think they're useful for themes. You know, it's a low cost way of doing it, and you get a good spread. So yes, I would if there's something. And I mean, an area that I guess is missing out there is sort of renewable energy, that sort of area. And I'd be amazed if by the end of this year, or maybe, you know, well, by the end of this year, if I don't have some exposure through something there. But also, you know, some of those will give you, there's two ways you can go. You can either go into a fund that's sort of developing new technology, or I guess you can go into one that pays a good dividend yield. So
it's already generated
wind power, like Bluefield Solar or something like that.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. That's brilliant. Thanks, John. That's been really, really useful. And I think, speaking to you, there's a couple of things I've sort of taken away from the conversation and about, you know, watching what you do over the years that we spoke about earlier. And that's the importance of the process and actually being able to sort of tweak and improve that process as you go along. And I guess the other thing is the time frame.
Yes.
Not being too worried about the here and now.
Yeah, I think time frame is really important because I think you should always, if you're investing in equities and you need the money next year or next month or in 6 months' time, then I don't really think you should be investing in equities. You know, the money I've got here is money that I just want to grow over the years and years ahead, and pay me an income, you know, in the future when I need it. So it's all about just building that pot and trying, you know, we'd all love to go up 1% every month. But it's not how it happens. You have good times. Last year was great. Year before wasn't so good. But it's really looking over, you know, over time and building up that record.
You mentioned a really great turning book, the Andrew Craig book.
Yes. How to Own the World, which I just read last week. And I read it in a couple of days. It was quite compelling reading. And I guess, I didn't... personally, for me, learn that much from it. Although there were some bits in terms of, you know, the gold bit, it sort of, well, it was a nice reinforcer. It made me feel good about my decision to have bought gold. But it's more aimed at people who are, I guess, you know, younger, in their 20s, 30s, about the importance of starting to invest, letting compounding happen. But there's very good pointers as well on how to value different markets, property as well, and how to value them, how not to get sucked into things at the top and all this sort of thing. So it was a good read. I think a lot of people should read that.
Excellent. Nice reading list pointer. The summer holidays, which now seem miles away, but there you go. Thank you, John. Let me just talk you through what else we've got in the magazine this week. It's been a quiet week on the results front. We've had obviously lots of news updates. The big news feature we've done this week is on the retail sector, where there have been lots of updates since the new year, and it's sort of mixed reading, some horrible stuff and middling stuff, and some actually a few companies that are doing quite well, not least Boohoo and Dunelm. We have plenty in the personal finance and funds section, which they will talk about on their podcast tomorrow. John's excellent column, obviously. All the usual tips and comments, including Phil Oakley looking this week at Darts Group, which you will know from watching the television advertising as Jet 2 holidays. He's looking there at sort of some of the pointers you can get on the types of analysis you can do on cyclical companies like this. Lots more in the news section, actually. Another look at what's going on with oil, a look across the pond at the US banking sector, and the cover feature this week, which is looking at M&A and which companies might be next on the target list for a takeover. Picking merger winners, written by the company's team. Thank you all for listening. Thanks again, John, for coming in. We'll have to have you on again soon because I think we've touched the tip of the iceberg there.
Thank you very much.
No problem at all. And pick up the magazine in all good news agents, and we'll be back again next week. Thank you.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years, too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.